Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar series, where great professors teach you. My name is George K. Wilson, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled God Wills It, Understanding the Crusades. Your professor is Thomas F. Madden, Professor of Medieval History and Chair of the Department of History at St. Louis University. A recognized expert on the Crusades, he has appeared in forums such as National Public Radio and the New York Times. Professor Madden is the author of The New Concise History of the Crusades. He is the editor of Crusades, The Illustrated History, and The Crusades, Essential Readings. Among his published journal articles are The Enduring Myths of the Fourth Crusade, Father of the Bride, Fathers, Daughters, and Dowries in Late Medieval and Early Renaissance Venice, and The Fires of the Fourth Crusade in Constantinople, 1203 through 1204, A Damage Assessment. For over 400 years, crusaders, those signed by the cross, marched to the Holy Land out of Christian zeal, a declared love for their fellow man, and in many cases, a simple desire for fortune, glory, and heavenly reward. The story of the Crusades is a story of passion, violence, and blind faith that sometimes led to destruction. Determined to reclaim the Holy Land in the name of Christ, crusaders traveled from the farthest reaches of Europe across mountains, deserts, and seas to fight an enemy they believed God wanted them to destroy. Much of what occurred during the Crusades has come down to us today in the form of continued suspicion among religious ideologies, not only between Christians and Muslims, but also internally among Christian sects, and to some degree among Muslim sects. Although the Crusades teach us no simple lessons, the stories of faith and ferocity are just as compelling as they were hundreds of years ago, when they motivated people of all classes to take up the cross, leave their homes, and journey to a strange land. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and, yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin God Wills It, Understanding the Crusades, Lecture 1, The Medieval Background of the Crusades. And now, Professor Madden.
Welcome to this course on the Crusades. The Crusades are a very fascinating topic. It is the story of a clash between two cultures, two faiths. It is a story very important for the development of Western Europe, as well as the development of the Islamic world. And so in this course, we're going to explore the Crusades, beginning at the beginning, and then tracing the history of the major Crusades that were waged in the Middle East, as well as those that were waged in Europe. The way that we will begin this course is by laying a foundation so that we will understand the world in which the Crusades were born. And to do that, what we need to do is first look at medieval Europe, how it came about, and in a general way, the kind of world that medieval people lived in that would eventually give birth to the idea of crusade. Secondly, and in the next lecture, lecture 2, we will lay the foundations for understanding medieval Islam and both the faith and the culture of Islam and the empire that Islamic warriors built. And then by understanding, having our understanding firmed up on both of those scores, we can then begin actually following the events of the Crusades, which will begin in Lecture 3 with the calling of the First Crusade by Urban II in 1095. We will then look at the First Crusade, which was a monumental expedition that was extremely, as it turns out, quite successful, and which at the end eventually conquers Jerusalem and lays the foundation for the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. With the conquest of Jerusalem in 1099, we will then back up a little bit and have a look at a general question of what were the Crusades? And then secondly, who were the Crusaders? Who were the men who joined Crusades? And what were the motivations that they had for joining a Crusade? We will then, in the subsequent lecture, Lecture 6, we will look at the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem and how it grew and consolidated in the aftermath of the First Crusade. In Lecture 7, we will look at the Second Crusade, and then in the following lectures, we will look at the Third Crusade and then the Fourth Crusade that was to go to Egypt but ended up destroying Constantinople, the greatest Christian city in the world. We will then trace the ways in which crusading was used in Europe. Then, in Lecture 11, we will look at the Fifth Crusade, the first major attempt to try to conquer Egypt. Lecture 12, we will explore the crusades of the great crusader king, Louis IX, or St. Louis. And finally, in the 13th lecture, we will look at the fall of the crusader states and their eventual extinction. And we'll wrap up the course with a final lecture on crusading after the crusader states were gone. Crusades, in other words, in the 14th century and in the 15th century, and even a bit in the 16th century. And we'll finish the course by discussing briefly the ways in which crusades were remembered, both in Europe and then how that memory of the Crusades was transferred then to the Muslim Middle East in the modern era. So I hope you'll enjoy this course and learn something useful from it. Before we do that, in this lecture and in our second lecture, we'll be getting some background so that we can understand what the Crusades were and what was the environment in which the Crusades came about. And so in this lecture, Lecture 1, we'll be looking at the medieval background of the Crusades, and in this respect, what's going on in Western Europe? What is it about the medieval world that brought forth this event, really an unprecedented sort of event of the Crusades? So the question always is where to begin on something like this, and the best thing to begin is at the beginning of the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages traditionally is seen by historians as being that period of European history that is in the middle. It is the period in between ancient Rome or the ancient world and the beginning of the early modern world. And if you want dates for that, usually historians will date that to the fall of the Roman Empire in the West around 450 AD or so, and then the fall of Constantinople in the East in 1453. So we have roughly 1,000 years to deal with the Middle Ages. Frequently, the Middle Ages are referred to as the Dark Ages. And although historians don't refer to them that way any longer, you still will often see it in popular media. We now know, however, that the medieval period and its world was not at all dark, that many of the innovations, inventions, things like the university or basic concepts come from the Middle Ages. Nevertheless, it was a world very much unlike our world today. And it's from this world. It's a world both more primitive, but also one infused with religion and religion making up a major part of the not only the worldview of the people, but also of their self-identification. And it is this world that the Crusades will come out of. In fact, the Crusades are really a defining component of the Middle Ages. They are uniquely medieval. And it's only by understanding that world that we'll be able to understand the Crusades. Christianity, which forms the backdrop for the Middle Ages, begins during the Roman Empire. It spreads fairly rapidly in the first century AD, in the first century after the death of Christ. It is largely, however, in the Roman Empire, it's largely an urban phenomenon. If you were looking for Christians in, say, 100 AD, then you would go to the big cities like Rome or Antioch or Alexandria or Ephesus or other large cities. That's why in the Paul's various letters of the New Testament are written to communities of Christians who are all in large cities. But it didn't spread into the countryside. It was popular among the lower classes, particularly slaves or day laborers in the cities, but it did also have some followings among aristocratic women, women of the highest noble families in Rome, and they would be exposed to Christianity by their household slaves. Estimates vary, but most historians would agree that by about 300 AD, approximately 10 to maybe 15% of the population of the Roman Empire was Christian. And as I said, that would have been predominantly the lower classes, with some sprinkling of upper classes as well. The church was the organization, the institution of the church, was very important to the Christians. And that's why we need to say a little something about the ecclesiology, or the way in which the church was ordered. The reason why it was important was that Christians believed that the institution of the church itself was necessary for the salvation of the faithful. The graces of God, they believed, came through the institution of the church, and therefore the way that it was ordered was crucial. At the highest level, as you might expect, was God. God provided salvation through Christ and through his church. Just below God and Christ is what was referred to as the apostolic foundation. And this is the apostles, what had been the 12 and then the 11 apostles of Christ, to whom Christ gave these special powers of administering the sacraments, performing the Mass, and spreading the faith. These special powers, this special authority that was given to the apostles, then was devolved down to, was given to others during the first generation of Christians, and these others became the shepherds of the flock, or the episcopo, or the bishops. So the authority of the bishops, therefore, came from the apostles, and when we refer to the apostolic foundation or to bishops, bishops are the therefore seen as the heirs to the apostles. Now, all bishops were considered to be brothers in, as far as their authority went. However, there were some bishops that were thought to have a special authority, and these were referred to as patriarchs. Initially, there were three patriarchates of Christianity, and they are, not surprisingly, the bishops of the three largest cities, Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria. A little bit later, they would add two other cities, Jerusalem, where the faith began, and the great city of Constantinople, which we'll talk more about later. Christians believed that God revealed himself and revealed his will and his understanding of the faith through councils of these bishops, just as had occurred in what was called the First Council of Jerusalem when the apostles came together after the death and ascension of Christ and asked for the guidance of the Holy Spirit. In the same way, bishops would do that. Bishops would come together and pray for the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and in this way, they would be able to answer questions about the faith and further refine their understanding of Christ and his faith. The bishop or patriarch of Rome, however, was believed from an early period to have had a special authority different than the other patriarchs or the other bishops. And this was because of the fact that every bishop could trace themselves back at some point to some apostle in the first generation of Christians. But the Bishop of Rome could trace his lineage directly back to St. Peter. Peter, who Christ had singled out as being the leader of the apostles, the one to whom Christ gave a special binding and loosing authority, had gone first to Antioch and then had ended up in Rome, where he was believed to be the first bishop of Rome, and then he was martyred there, probably in the persecution of Nero. Since the Pope was, and the Pope is a word that it's an anglicization of the Italian Papa, which just means father, but the Pope is in fact the bishop or the patriarch of Rome, and that special authority comes to him because he is the direct successor of St. Peter. In other words, popes argued from very early period that they were, just as Peter was the prince of the apostles, they were the leader of all of the other bishops, and therefore the leader of the church, and that they alone had this special binding and loosing authority that Christ had given to Peter. Now, of course, other bishops or other patriarchs might not have always agreed with that. In fact, they frequently did not agree with it. But that didn't stop the popes from making the argument that, in fact, this authority did come to them in a special way. And it was generally agreed, even in the early centuries, that when two bishops had a disagreement, that that disagreement should be sent to Rome to be decided. And in most cases, whichever side Rome favored, the winning side of that argument would always say, well, see, there you are, the St. Peter has spoken, and therefore we now know what God wants. And the person who lost the agreement would say, well, that Pope doesn't have any special authority anyway. Christianity's changed dramatically. Its fortunes changed dramatically with the conversion of the Emperor Constantine in 312 at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. Constantine believed that he had a vision in which Christ promised him victory at this battle. And when he in fact won against overwhelming odds, he immediately converted to Christianity. The conversion of an emperor to Christianity was a major change for the religion, particularly when one considers that the religion was in the throes of its largest persecution, the persecution of Diocletian. So it went from being a faith that was actively persecuted to becoming now the faith of the emperor of the known world. And that meant that suddenly it would become a real mainstream religion. It was no longer a religion of the lowest classes. It was now very quickly picking up adherents in all levels of society, including now the highest levels of society. Constantine very strongly believed that he had been chosen by God to lead not only the Roman Empire, but to repair his church. And so right away, Constantine went into the process of finding out what was wrong with the church and trying to find a way to fix it. The church did need some fixing by the 4th century, and this is largely as a result of the various persecutions which occurred, but also because Christianity had spread rapidly, and it had developed different ways in different places. And that was a problem for Christians, because the truth had to be unified. There is only one truth, and therefore that truth had to be understood by all. Those who were wrong, Christians believed, would be punished in the afterlife. And so it was necessary that they understand what the truth was. The big heresy, a big controversy that was occurring around this time, was one about the nature of Christ, which is referred to as Arianism. Arians believed that Christ was less than God. He was divine, but not a deity. And so to settle this question, Constantine organized what's called an ecumenical church council, a very, very large council of the patriarchs, of leading bishops from all over the Roman Empire, to come to his palace at Nicaea, a very pleasant, prosperous town in Asia Minor, what's today Turkey, right on the banks of a very pleasant lake. And there in 325, the bishops met and they discussed the various sides of this argument, and they discussed many other questions of the faith, and eventually came to their conclusions. And therefore, it is at Nicaea in 325, with the support of the Roman Emperor, that orthodoxy in the church is defined. And in fact, a creed is then written, the Nicene Creed, which lays out what are the basic building blocks of the faith. Under the sponsorship of the emperors over the next century or two, Christianity would spread very rapidly. In fact, in the 4th century itself, it saw very, very rapid expansion throughout all of the Roman Empire. All of the rest of the Roman emperors would be Christians, with the exception of only one, Julian the Apostate, who was not an emperor for very long. By 392, things had changed so much. This is by the end of the 4th century. Things had changed so much that it was possible for the Roman emperor, Theodosius, to outlaw paganism, all of the old cults of the ancient world, and to therefore de facto make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. This is a remarkable change, given that this same empire had been actively persecuting this religion less than a century earlier. So that's how Christianity both began and grew in the Roman Empire. As you probably know, things were going to start going downhill for the Roman Empire shortly thereafter, largely as a result of Germanic or barbarian invasions which occurred in Western Europe. Rome was a vast empire that encompassed the entire Mediterranean, but the western half of it had been under incredible pressure from these Germanic groups who were coming into the empire and then were setting up their own independent kingdoms within Western Europe. And so by the traditional date is 476 AD. By 476 AD, we can talk about the end of the Roman Empire in the West. There's really nothing left of the Roman Empire in the western half of the Mediterranean or in Western Europe. Instead, what you have are various barbarian kingdoms that are set up on the ruins of the old empire. But it's important to remember that the Roman Empire continues and is still quite healthy in the eastern half of the Mediterranean. And that had always been the far more populated area. There's many more people who live in the eastern Mediterranean than there are in the West. And it's also the more Christian area. Four of the five patriarchates of Christianity were all in the eastern half of the empire. And so for them, everything was just fine. The daily routine continued as it had before, while in the West, a completely different world was being born, the medieval world. Historians refer to the Roman Empire after 476, in other words, the Roman Empire that did not fall in the East, as the Byzantine Empire. Why we historians call it the Byzantine Empire is a good question. There's really no good answer to it. They called themselves Romans. Everyone else called them Romans. It's one of those many terms that were set in stone during the 18th century Enlightenment that we're kind of stuck with. So when you hear me throughout these lectures refer to the Byzantine Empire, just remember that what that means is the Roman Empire that has still survived in the East. And when I refer to Byzantines, I'm referring to Romans in the East. Constantine, when he was still emperor, before the empire had fallen, had set up a new capital for the empire in the East. The capital of the Roman Empire had always been, logically enough, Rome. But he wanted to create a new one for administrative purposes, a new capital in the East that would have jurisdiction over the eastern half of the empire. And with the fall of the West, this becomes now the capital of the Roman Empire. Constantine initially named his city New Rome, and he had created it to be truly a new Rome. It was a massive city. But most people just refer to it as Constantine's city, which in the Greek would become Constantinopolis or Constantinople. He had chosen Constantinople in the most optimum strategic location. It commanded both the Bosporus Strait, which is the only way to get from by sea from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. You have to sail right by Constantinople, and right at a point at which the Roman road went between Europe and Asia. So it was truly at the crossroads of the world. It still is. He also heavily fortified it, building massive fortifications all around this very massive city. And these fortifications would hold for many, many, many centuries. And therefore, it will be there at Constantinople that you will have now what will become a Christian capital of the Roman Empire, and it would remain the greatest city in Christendom for many centuries. The Byzantines, the Romans in the East, although they continued to remain interested in events in the West, their gaze was naturally taken up more with events in their own part of the world, in the Eastern Mediterranean. In particular, the problems in Persia, or the Parthians, or, as we'll see later, with the Arab Muslims. The Germanic tribes that came into the West were, which historians and Romans referred to as barbarians, took apart the Roman Empire. But before they arrived, to varying degrees, these Germans had been already Romanized to a certain extent. They had had a lot of interaction with Roman culture on the frontiers, and so most of them spoke some form of Latin, and most of them were Christians. The rub here is that they were Arian Christians, that heresy that had been outlawed before in the East would now come into the West. And that meant there was going to be a certain amount of animosity between the Romans, the native Romans who lived in Western Europe, and the new conquerors, the Germans, who were Arian Christians. Later, however, the Germans would eventually all convert to Roman Catholicism. The fall of Rome, as I mentioned, would have dramatic consequences in Europe. Big cities were now depopulated. Cities like Rome or Milan lost most of their population. Big cities require lots and lots of surplus. They require lots of service industries that bring them food and all of the things that they need to keep large populations. Without that, these cities depopulated. People went out to live on the land, to grow agriculture. And so everything became much more local and much more primitive than it had been before. New military technologies, which would come into Europe over the next few centuries, in particularly the stirrup. The stirrup may seem like a fairly simple invention that someone would have thought of before this, but in fact, it was a Chinese invention which only came to Europe in about the 6th century and only got widespread use a little after that. The stirrup was important because it allowed now, for the first time in European history, horses to be used in a military applications that were actually effective. This means that you can get on a horse, you can fuse the horse and the rider together with that stirrup, and that means you can begin what's called the Frankish charge. You put someone on a horse, you give them a very long pole, you have them pointed at something they don't like, and charge. And the amount of energy which is imparted at the end of that pole is enormous. The problem, of course, is that a horse is very expensive, and the training that it takes to be able to actually do something like the Frankish charge is enormous. In fact, you really have to begin as a boy to learn how to do it properly, and in particular to do it with others. So given the expense and given the amount of time that it takes, that means that really only the aristocracy in Europe are going to be able to do that. And so what you get in medieval Europe is a warrior aristocracy. The nobility of Europe are, in essence, warriors. And they are defined by the fact that they are warriors. And they're also defined by the horse. They are knights. They are the ones who ride the horses. Feudalism is simply a way to try to mobilize those mounted knights. Because it takes an enormous amount of wealth to do that, because there is no real liquid currency, there's not much money in Western Europe at all because there's no government to issue it, feudalism is a way of providing the necessary resources to be able to outfit these mounted knights. In feudalism, a lord gives away lands for the use of someone else, and this someone else is referred to as his vassal. And the vassal swears to God. Nobody can read, so this is all just swearing to God. He swears to God that he will protect him and that he will come annually, every year, usually for 40 days, with all of the troops that that land can support. And so at its root, that's all feudalism is. It's a series of agreements where land is parceled out so that it can be used for military purposes. In the 9th and the 10th centuries, Europe would be hit by a wave of really three different invasions that would really enormously affect Europeans. It would be much more destructive than the German invasions. The Germans were Christians, after all, and they were Romanized. They respected Roman culture, and they were themselves Christians. These new invaders in the 9th and the 10th centuries were not Romanized, and they were not Christians. All of this meant that Europe became militarized. If I am a local lord, and I have my lands around me, and I'm being attacked by the Vikings, and I ask my lord to come and help me, well, the feudal system is not designed as a rapid deployment force. It takes a long time for someone to put out a feudal call and then to have the levies actually arrive. So that means I need to defend my lands by myself. And that means that what I do is I build a fort, which eventually will become a castle. And so castles spring up all over Europe, and also Europe itself becomes much more militarized in this attempt to try to defend against these new invasions. If you notice, in this example I just used, everything becomes much more local. And because of that, people are not much concerned about what's going on beyond their own horizons. And so this localization of interest really hurts the church, because in the West there's not a connection any longer between a local bishop, say, and the Pope in Rome. And that means what you end up with is a kind of a scattering of various practices in various areas of Europe. And what are called clerical abuses begin to creep in. In particular, priests or bishops being married, which becomes very common, called Nicolaism, concubinage, which means that I'm a bishop and I know I'm not supposed to get married, so I just live with someone, and simony, which is the buying and selling of these ecclesiastical offices. It's not until the 10th century, when the dust is starting to settle from these invasions, that people are able to raise their heads up and look around and try to find some way to reform the church, to fix the damage that had happened to the church. And it's around this time, particularly at a monastery known as Cluny, that reformers, a kind of new breed of reformers, begin working, first of all, to restore discipline in the monasteries. Many of the monasteries have become quite lax. And the nobility is behind this too, because if the nobles are the patrons of these monasteries, and they're patrons because the monks will pray for them, pray for their souls. And therefore, it's in every noble's interest to have a monastery that is pious and filled with good, pious men that God will want to listen to. And so Cluny becomes a kind of a wellspring of reform, of monastic reform. They send out brothers from Cluny to monasteries all over Europe. And it's very successful. Hundreds and hundreds of monasteries are reformed, and they restore discipline and piety to those various monasteries. The reformers also wanted to reform the church, not just the monasteries. And for that, they argued that what they needed to do first was restore papal authority over the church. In this period, popes in Rome had also become quite localized in their interests, and as a result, had not been paying attention to the church or enforcing discipline. And so that's the first thing that these reformers want to do, is to get the Pope to start paying attention to the church again. And the second, which many of them believed was the root cause of these clerical abuses, was to eliminate lay control over the clergy. Because at that time, a bishop or an abbot, someone who controls lots of feudal lands, would normally be chosen by the lord of those lands. And that person may not actually have the best interests of the church at heart. So get rid of lay control over the clergy. These ideas were eventually put into effect in the 11th century. The German emperor, Henry III, brought down troops to deal with a problem in Rome, a very difficult problem in which there were multiple popes, and it would become really quite a scandal. So he went down to Rome, he threw out all of the popes, and put in his own popes. These were Germans, and they were reformers. They were Cluniac reformers. And the first of these real reform popes was Leo IX. He was a tireless reformer. He traveled a lot, convening synods all across Europe, where he would depose any bishops who had bought their offices. These synods and these reform efforts worked fairly well. They also caused a lot of bishops to be upset with him as well. But they also brought a side effect, which was quarrels with the church in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. And in an attempt to try to end these quarrels with the Christians of the East, he sent a papal legate, Cardinal Humbert, to Constantinople. And there they tried to work things out, and the two just didn't get along. Finally, their relations broke down so much that in 1054, Humbert excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople and left the city. This is what's traditionally known as the schism between the Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox churches in 1054. In reality, this was not a schism. Historians know that the real break between the two churches didn't come till much later. But it is a dramatic event, and therefore it has come to be seen as a break between those two. So if you're ever on Jeopardy and they ask you when the schism was, its answer is 1054. Henry III died in 1056 and left a very young son, Henry IV. Regent governments are always weak, and that gave the reformers in Rome, who are now firmly in power in Rome, the opportunity to go on to the next step of reform, and that is remove lay control over the clergy. And the place to start is lay control over the Pope. And so Pope Nicholas II, in 1059, issues what's called the Papal Election Decree. And in this, it states that henceforth, emperors or others will not be picking popes or installing them, but rather the suffragans or the cardinals will all get together, they'll get locked away where no one can exert any influence on them, they'll pray for guidance from the Holy Spirit, and then they'll elect the pope. All of this would end up causing tensions with the German emperor by the time he got old enough to notice what was going on. And this would particularly explode with the pontificate of Gregory VII. Gregory VII, who was the pope from 1073 to 1085, was really the high watermark of these reformers. He was a very, very strong reformer. In fact, so much so that historians often refer to the entire reform movement as the Gregorian Reform. He pursued now this next stage of the reform agenda, and that is to get rid of this lay control over ecclesiastical appointments. And so in 1075, he issued an edict in which he prohibited lay investiture of the clergy. In other words, the laity giving the clergy their authority. The Emperor Henry IV defied this edict and, in fact, called for the deposition of the Pope. Gregory responded by excommunicating Henry and deposing him. Without any armies, Gregory just wrote a letter. He said that the most powerful secular ruler in Western Europe was no longer the ruler, and it worked. His princes abandoned him, and finally Henry was forced in 1077 to go to the Pope's winter palace in Canossa, and there stand outside the palace for 3 days. We're told he stood in the snow for 3 days barefoot, and beg forgiveness from the Pope, wailing and asking him to please forgive him for having done this horrible thing. The Pope looked out his window and saw the Emperor wailing and begging and let him stay out there, as I say, for 3 days before finally bringing him in, hearing his confession, and absolving him. In reality, of course, Henry was only doing this to save his throne, and he did save his throne, but after 3 more years, when he was sure of his power and he had punished all of those who had abandoned him during his previous fight with the Pope, he once again defied Gregory, and this time Gregory's excommunication didn't work. Henry came down with his troops, he invaded Rome, Gregory was forced to flee, and so as a result, Gregory died in exile. It looked like a defeat for the Pope and for the Reformed papacy, but in fact it wasn't. The Pope in Rome, or out of Rome, would continue to have this fight, and what historians refer to as the investiture controversy, would continue to go between the Pope and the Emperor for many more decades. But nevertheless, as time went on, it was clear that the papacy had the upper hand. Papal authority would continue to rise, and the authority or the ability of German emperors to actually command even just Germany, let alone all of Europe, continue to erode. And so as a result of this, the papacy was ascending in power, and this brings us into what historians frequently refer to as the papal monarchy, a period in medieval history in which the popes become de facto the real rulers of Europe. On our next lecture, what we will do is look at the background of the Crusades from the other side of the Crusades, and that is from the perspective of the Muslim world, and see what occurred in the Muslim world first at the beginning of the faith, its rapid expansion across the Mediterranean, and then how this would then be reacted to by the medieval West.
This ends Lecture 1.